Well, welcome to this podcast, Making Waves. My name's Clive Coldwell. Haven't heard from me for a while. It's just as well. I always try and hide away when necessary. But it's about the seventh or eighth podcast we're doing now, so we're gaining momentum. It's coming on. And the key thing here is just to find out interesting things about people. And so far, we've hit the jackpot with all kinds of jolly interesting sorts that the AV world's producing. And today, we've got Jamie Brothwell, who's Chief Sales and Commercial Officer for Exertis UK. Hello, Jamie.
Hello,
Clive. Thanks for driving in your posh car.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you used to be director of AV from August to July. So what happened between you going from director of AV to chief sales and commercial officer?
So effectively, I gained extra responsibility for the purchasing and the marketing departments. So our business as a whole, effectively from a DCC Technologies perspective, who we're owned by, our technology divisions were split into three. So first, Pro Solutions, which I'll come back to, then Infotech, and then Lifetech. So effectively, Infotech is the traditional retail and B2B business. Lifetech is more white goods, consumer-type products, but mostly in North America through the acquisition of Almo. And then Pro Solutions, which I work within, encompasses our AV, enterprise and services business, and that really is our core focus as an organization. As a whole, it's a 1.5 billion business globally now, over 20 countries and over 500 dedicated employees. So it's quite a substantial business, and as a result of that division, if you like, we took purchasing and marketing into my remit.
So has the company itself been changing, or have you been looking at it more seriously and consolidating what it should have been doing, having a jolly good look at how the business operates and providing your organisation and cultural expertise to help improve things?
I think it's a culmination of things, essentially. One is you have to keep evolving. And two is the importance that we place upon the AV business in the UK, and recognise the fact that if we want to be successful, then we have to be more specialist in our approach. So effectively, I always look at our business as an ice cream parlour. On the outside, we present all the different flavours, but on the back end, perhaps we've been traditionally more generic. So what we're trying to do is effectively marry the two, hence breaking out certain areas. And actually what it's enabled us to do, particularly from a stock perspective, is we've actually doubled our stock holding, but we've improved our return on working capital because we recognise, again, AV doesn't necessarily fit into the traditional retail and B2B model that Exertis would have been more famous for traditionally. So it's more of a project business, so we have to go long in terms of our stock. So we've put a huge amount of work into that. And equally, this year, we're investing heavily in marketing in terms of really bringing the Exertis AV brand to life. So that will be around the actual brand itself, but also the events that we hold, and in terms of technology, but also lifestyle such as diversity. And to do that, we need to have that specialism and greater depth. So we've put big investment in that, and we've got a big budget this year for that. And previously, we haven't done it because we were getting our house in order. And I think equally, I'm a great believer, there's no point going out and telling the world that we're amazing when we're not. So I think we're in a really great place this year, and I'm really excited for FY25.
Well, they're in a great place with you on board. I mean, you know, to have, you know, expertise in change management and business transformation, I mean, they couldn't get a better person in that position, surely. Can't be many of you around, Jamie.
I would say...
Not in AV, at least.
Most people would probably regard me as unique, I would say, but I'm proud of that. I think Anthony Bate, who was obviously a well-known figure in the AV industry at Roche, said to me, he said, it's good to be different, Jamie, and I believe I certainly am. And I think that, you know, certainly my... I've always, throughout my career, recognised the areas in any business that isn't working and thrown my hat in the ring and said, I want to fix that. And it started way, way back at Midwich with print, which is where I did a lot of my early work. Latterly at Midwich, I took over the SMB floor and fixed that, then went to Samsung, fixed that, then joined Exertis. I actually went to Exertis and when I was at Samsung, because I wanted to get back into distribution, yeah, recognised their print business wasn't performing. So I said, let me fix your print business. And they said, yeah, we were looking to bring somebody into the business. And I said, oh, right. And they said, do you know anyone? I said, yes. they say, are you interested? I was like, yes. And the rest, as they say, is history. And then I've a culmination of roles, which I'm sure we'll talk about more, in terms of basically business turnaround. That's really, I would regard as my specialism.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you have had a lot of interesting periods of experience that, you know, I've never planned anything in my life. Goodness knows why I'm ending up on AV Magazine, because all my life for 42 years, I've gained experience doing things that have helped me do the next job. I never thought about what are my skills now and what can I do best. I seem to be very lucky to be able to tackle things based on the experience I've had beforehand. Not everybody has that luxury. Mm. It took 3 redundancies and everything else. So you have a bit of bruising along the way, but it prepares you and creates a better manager and a different perspective on things that people perhaps may not otherwise see. So I think you've got a lot of interesting skills there that perhaps are unique in, I hate that word, but you know, in a way that enables you to be flexible enough to be able to accommodate change, but putting it into context of what's happening around you so that the change and the context fit nicely together. You know, it seems the timing's right for you at the minute, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very...
And for the company.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's interesting. I'm a great believer that in life and in work, the more situations you've dealt with, the more you have in your toolkit to deal with situations. And I think certainly in my life, there's not much I haven't done in terms of life experience and challenge and generally overcome them. I always say I think I'm the type of person you'd want to get stuck on a desert island with, because I generally have this ethos of just knowing what to do and kind of hopefully inspiring people to kind of follow and go on that journey. And I think certainly with business transformation, I think it's incredibly satisfying. I'm a great believer you learn more when things are not going your way than when they are.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more. And I don't think enough people have those pain periods in their life to be, in a way, at the right time for them to learn properly about what happened, why it happened, and how you deal with it. You don't actually rationalise at the time. You just try and survive and get through it.
Yeah. I talk a lot. I have a lot of analogies and I have a lot of quotes, and anybody that works with me will kind of know I'm kind of famous for them. And but one of the things that I look upon is, I call it my omelette model, and I created it. And I think the challenge I think most managers have is that they get everybody in a room, or they get everyone together and they say, right, we're cooking omelets, and then they think their job's done. And then when they come back and get 28 different omelets, they go, what went wrong here?
Yeah.
My philosophy is we don't leave anything to chance. So we look at what are the ingredients, how long do we cook it for, and what is the perfect omelet we're all trying to achieve, and then show everybody what it looks like. And then that way the chance of failure is less. And I think I always talk about the fact that we have a recipe, and it's not just me. I have a brilliant team of people around me. And together, we've all got lots of experience in terms of the job. You know, I started very much at the bottom, done every job in sales and commercial pretty much now since. I've got a brilliant commercial director who is first class in what he does. But all of us together, I'm a great believer. I know what I'm good at and I know what I'm not. And so I get great people in to do the things I'm not good at, and together we win. And I think it is really about getting good people and trusting them to do what they do.
Individuality, which is something I quite likes to nurture. How far does the developing individuals and a unique talent that may or may not, you know, be able to do the things you can't do as well, how far do you let that go before then it's sort of captured in this common goal ethos that you have?
I think personal development is a huge focus area for me. In terms of with our people.
Does a common goal kill that individuality at some point? This sounds like one of those interview questions.
Yeah, it does.
Don't mean to sound awful for it, but, you know, it's interesting. I love the development of an individual, but there has to be a point of where there's that realism that they are working as part of a team, they have a common goal. But the difficulty, the conflict comes when you're trying to get the most of that development of a skill which may be unique, but sorely needed by the team. And almost there's this new area of management where everybody swivels. according to the skill that they require for that particular task. So you might have a leader in one thing, it might be a different leader for another. It's almost like a flat management approach to pointing, which sometimes I tried here, pointing to the particular skill you want in motion at that particular time, even though there may be an overall goal that you need to reach. That takes some managing, really, and it's almost a feel and a gut approach to it that really is quite difficult to find in people these days.
Yeah, I think that one of the areas that we did a recent away day back in January, where we took the whole of the business together over a weekend, and we presented what our vision is, and we presented our results and also our way forward. But one of the exercises we did on the day, I had learning and development come along, and we did SDI core strengths with all of our people. So, and then we mapped where all of our people sit on kind of a map in terms of it focus around on performance, people and process.
Yeah.
And so
three P's.
Yeah, 3 P's, absolutely. And the whole purpose of that was really allowing everybody to, first and foremost, what we did was we got everybody to do the exercise. I asked everybody to then read their personal report. We then brought everyone into the room and asked everybody to plot where they thought people were. And the difference between where people thought people were versus where they were was quite different.
Yeah, but it was.
And the purpose of the exercise was, the better we know each other, the better we can work with each other, but also understand how we think and where we go in points of conflict as well.
Because people are quite protective, aren't they, of their weaknesses, and don't want to publicise or let people know what they're like. They try and cover it over, don't they?
Absolutely. I have it's really interesting because...
Human nature, I suppose.
Well, we work together as teams. So you've got sales, you've got commercial, you've got purchasing, and they might have differing views of certain situations, or we notice that we've dropped off in business, in a brand, in a customer, and so we go and ask, we think we might have dropped off here, can we go and find out? More often than not, people will take that as almost offensively. It's like as if somebody's walked in their living room and pissed on their children.
Yeah.
But the reality is that it's a gift, and I think that we need to take that gift, embrace it, and then go and find out, because it might actually help us win.
Absolutely.
So it's really changing the mentality around the fact that we are trying to work together to improve our business. We're not trying to offend one another.
No, I think you said it actually before when talking about you beat yourself up a bit. I think you've got to have a very strong self-critical element within you that keeps yourself in check. I mean, the most successful managers I've met have been brutal on themselves.
Yep.
And they've always considered themselves flexible enough to think they're still learning. Mm. And then comes the point of how do you manage other people to have that similar sort of mindset? You have to come to the conclusion they may not. I'd have to get around it in some way and put forward the points you passionately believe in a way that they feel comfortable with. It's not easy.
Yeah, I think I'm very much the type of person that if I brought it to any situation, whether it be cars, work, I will always focus on what's not right. Tim, my CEO, calls it an overplayed strength. But, you know, essentially I'm always trying to improve, be better, looking at those marginal gains. And I think that what I try to do, and I believe I do very well with the team, is that I really care about our people and want people to succeed and be the best version of themselves. And so I think because of the relationship I have with people, because I speak and engage with everybody in the AV business at all levels. I don't sit in an office. When I visit, we have 3 sites, Burnley, Basingstoke and Snetterton, where we have AV people. I sit on the sales floor with those people when I go in. I engage with them all, talk to them all, listen to calls, pick up things, make suggestions. And I think from my perspective, everybody knows that, one, everybody's got a direct line into me, but two, when I advise, help, support, offer advice, it's coming from a place of heart to help them succeed. And I believe that that's key.
Well, Jamie Brothwell, it's refreshing to hear that. And Tim might beat me up for saying it, but I think he's ever playing that card himself. I think it's refreshing. And it instills loyalty and a closeness with your employees that they feel as though... Well, I think when you expose yourself and make yourself look a little vulnerable, say, well, we're all human here, we make the same mistakes, it's how we learn from them and improve ourselves and be honest about that. They have more trust in you ultimately at the end of the day, and it brings people on with you to to support what you're doing, but ultimately they're supporting themselves. They're having an ownership of what they're doing. And if you instill that belief in people, then you create some of the best managers who may move on and do other things or move and do great things, put them on separate projects. They have that mindset that where everybody ultimately works together in the most amazing coordinated teams, I've found. We've done that here a bit, actually.
One of the things
give people ownership.
Yeah, totally. I mean, one of the things for me is, as well, I got asked at a recent panel discussion around diversity, how do you be a good ally? And I said, I think this is something that people overthink. I think, how about just saying hello to everybody you meet?
What's an ally?
An ally, so a supporter to a particular group of people, or be it LGBTQ or any kind of group of individuals, but how do you support one another? And I think for me, I make the point of every single person in the office I walk past, I say hello to and ask them ask them a question and just engage with people, take an interest in people.
Just a respect for them, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think we haven't been taught to do that over recent years. It's been a bit too competitive, perhaps, especially in sales environments where people are notoriously a bit cutthroat. They're part of a bit of a clan. You know, anybody who's a bit different gets hammered on the head. It's a difficult thing to keep that intenseness of getting that sort of, what they call that, what's the word I'm looking for, that tribal thinking of the group of people have, and almost bring out individuals. You can't have both together, or some people don't think you can.
You touched on something there, actually, that I'd bring up. So I've been that person that's different, that's been ridiculed and singled out and not included. And I think that's, for me, where why I'm so passionate about driving an inclusive environment, an engaging environment where everybody can truly be themselves and try and bring that out in people, because I know how that feels.
Yeah.
And so I don't want anyone else to have to feel how I did, and also give everybody fair opportunity to succeed. I was once given a piece of advice in my early career, which is, Jamie, you need to be more corporate if you want to get on. And I don't agree with that. I think actually being authentic, being true, you know, I wear my heart on my sleeve. People invest in that, is my opinion.
They do. And, you know, we've all had bad things happen to us. Some of us bury them, some of us adapt to them, you know, but on the whole, they bury them and think, well, perhaps I'm doing that wrongly. That self-belief comes a much later age, I found.
Yeah.
And I've had everything thrown at me over the years and come through some of them, not come through others. And it's a very difficult thing to adapt to and to wear. I've learned how to do it by almost adopting a different style without compromising my beliefs. Respecting others, but at the same time, changing the way I behave to people in a way that doesn't conflict with my own particular beliefs is one way of doing it. But these sort of skills aren't taught. You know, you're sometimes you're learning them in a quite brutal environment, which sales tends to be.
Yeah.
Now, just one little question before I go on to your other passion, which is clearly what people are sort of leading on to, is the relationship that the holding company has with Exertis. How do you work together? Are they just there to provide the money, keep a close watching eye? How much interaction does Tim have with everything?
Well, Tim's is the CEO of the UK business, so Tim's very much involved. Tim is in the office every day of the week if he's not out with customers and vendors. So no, Tim's very active. My boss, I actually report into Europe. So my boss is actually based in Paris, and we have regular contact. We build very in-depth 3-year plans, which are shared with DCC. DCC Technology have a very clear vision of what they want the future to look like, and our job's to build it and make it happen. And, you know, we've been very acquisitive as an organization globally, and we'll continue to do so. And technology is a really exciting industry that's changed my life. So very active. They're not just, I think, as you alluded to, kind of the money people. They are very much engaged, interested. I direct catch up with Donal, CEO, only a few weeks ago, and, you know, remarkable guy. And you touched on one other thing, actually, because we had the same conversation you said earlier about your career, and you'd not necessarily had a plan, and Donal actually said the same. I'm sure he won't mind me saying that. Whereas with me, I've always had a plan. I've always had a goal. I'm not there yet. I'm getting there. But 11 years ago, I decided I was going to join Exertis. I was going to take over print. I was going to set up an office in Norfolk. I was going to take over AV. And I had a conversation with my now commercial director who worked at Midwich at the time, and I worked at Samsung then, and told him I was going to do this. And he said, "Have you spoken to Exertis yet?" I was like, "No, but I'm going to make it happen." And a year later, I joined Exertis. 10 years on, I have an office in Norfolk, run AV at Sorted Print. Print obviously exists today. We've got 25 people working out of the Norfolk office. So I have a very clear vision. And I don't always know how I'm going to get there, but I always know I will.
Well, it begs the question, what is your ultimate goal? And how do you get that vision in your head that you want to get there?
So for me, ultimate goal is to run a business such as Exertis in its entirety.
Yeah, clearly.
And I want to create a culture that is the best in the industry, and I want to be the benchmark that everyone wants to work for us, everyone enjoys working for us, and really being able to change other people's lives like the industry's changed mine.
Will you still talk to me when you get the top job?
I talk to everybody.
Now then. That's what my wife said. That doesn't quite materialise, sadly. You've got this encyclopedic knowledge of the Ford car range for almost four decades of following the brand, an amazing social media following that I'm only now just beginning to realise. I've seen you on and off on LinkedIn and various other things. How on earth did this come about, and how's it grown so big, and how have you got time to do it?
It's interesting because whereas on my career, I had very clear vision and plan. This was something that just kind of happened by accident.
It's amazing, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
gone mad.
I think this is where it's really interesting. We live in a society where so many young people want to be an influencer, but yet they want to be exactly the same, which the two things are not, kind of don't go hand in hand. And I think for me, I never had a dream of being an influencer. I don't even regard myself as an influencer. I just follow a passion. And basically, I was pure accident. I bought a Focus RS when the new Mark III came out in 2016, did a few bits to it, and noticed that people started posting my car online. And at first I was quite annoyed. And then I thought, well, if you can't beat them, join them. So I think after a month, I'd got 1,000 followers on Instagram. And, you know, I'm on car 53 now.
No.
Yeah, I've had 53 cars.
Grief.
I've worked very closely with Ford, built nearly 44,000 followers on Instagram. I've got YouTube, which I don't do so much. I get invited to a lot of events. But it's just a passion. I've got 6 cars that I own now. At the moment, we've just rebuilt Max Power Project 2000. That's nearly finished, which was the most famous car in the Max Power era, which was a car magazine of the kind of 90s and 2000s.
I remember it.
Yeah, and that's pink, so that's quite well known, and it's great. Do you know what's really interesting though with it? If I didn't have it, I wouldn't miss it. It is a passion, and it served me very well. But it's not something that defines my life. And actually, a lot of the reason why I post the cars on LinkedIn is to deflect what I'm actually doing,
right,
which is working. So while everybody thinks, oh, Jamie's doing all this car stuff, it takes 30 seconds to post a picture of a car. But what you rarely see, I tend to only post where I'm coming to events like coming to see you today, or diversity events. When it comes to actually business and what we're doing and who we're seeing, you'll never see anything from me on social media because I don't want to share what we're actually up to.
Yeah,
so it's almost a smokescreen and a kind of a red herring, if you like, to the outside world, albeit I do enjoy sharing it.
Mr. David Berman, who's with us today, you've driven some of these cars, haven't you, David?
Some exciting vehicles, yeah, but not. I'm quite envious of the vehicle you're in today because I think that could do with a little bit of a leg stretch by Mr. Berman. I am available for some test drives later. I'm not sure whether the company insurance would probably cover it.
Yeah,
I have had a few. I have had a few nice cars, including my favourite time was going to a show in Amsterdam and then driving down to the Nürburgring to meet my brother, and then ragging my Z4 around the Nürburgring for a while. Do you do a lot of track days and the events you do?
I don't. We did a Jonathan Palmer customer day last year, which I did pretty well at. But no, I wouldn't take my own cars on track. It's the other people I worry about, and yeah. I just, no. I'm not really actually, believe it or not, I'm actually not really a fan of going fast. When we did the Jonathan Palmer day, I rather regretfully, enjoyed taking the team out, but rather regretfully suggested we had a hair of the dog, which I regretted in the morning when we were driving 189 miles an hour down the back straight at Bedford Aerodrome.
Imagine.
I don't really like driving fast. I was lifting off on the straight at 180 because it was just too much.
So racing's not on your...
No.
Exertis do sponsor racing, don't they?
Well, they had that customer day at Silverstone, I think, many years ago.
Yes. We did our plug-in to Exertis event at Silverstone, and there was kind of passenger rides and stuff. But no, we don't sponsor any racing as
well,
such.
Well, I am available if you need a driver. Just saying.
He always says that. He ends up in a taxi.
I try my best not to let anyone drive any of my cars.
No, you don't.
I like to stay friends with people.
You've done well so far, but while you're in the studio, your keys have been lifted from the bag.
They've been duplicated, haven't they?
With Project 2000, I'll say to anybody, if you can get in it, you can drive it, because it's got a full roll cage and it's hard work, to be honest, to get in and out of.
Blimey. This is the problem I have. I have it winched in and winched out. I'd love an AMG GT, for example, but I could never get in or out one, you know. I have all this. I used to be a Formula One writer and reporter. I used to interview all these.
Wow.
But the Formula One guys drove two Harvard. They were pretty boring cars.
See, yeah.
Schumacher had a Volvo Estate. I thought you had, those amazing cars on the track. Nothing else will do, will it?
It's interesting. Michael Schumacher.
The cars they got the sponsor given them. Which it hardly drove, actually.
Michael Schumacher is my childhood hero. And I actually use Formula One quite a lot in my in my kind of team talks and at the kickoff. And we talked about, I think there's a lot you can compare with Formula One in terms of bringing the team together and building not just for this year, but for next year's car in terms of our three-year plan. And because I'm a bit of a statistician and I'm kind of like, if I really like something, I kind of know everything about it. If I don't, I don't. And I looked at, Ferrari in the Michael Schumacher era, when it started in 96, Red Bull from their inception in 2005, and Mercedes from their inception in 2010, each of those three teams, which dominated Formula One essentially, took 5 years to win their first championship together. And that's where I look at kind of our business. And I use a quote a lot, which is a Michael Schumacher quote, which is the flowers of victory belong in many vases. And that I'm a great believer that in our business, every single person is contributing to where we want to be and winning.
Do you think that's a good taste to bring younger, talented people in the industry? We're not doing something right, are we, if that's the right way of phrasing it? How do we sell our industry that can perhaps be appealing to sales, marketing, technicians, everything else? I mean, you see some bits of the industry doing well, others aren't. I just wonder what we're doing wrong.
I think
not like electronic engineering, which is a defined career path. We're a bit, Avery's a bit not quite conventional in that regard, is it?
Yeah, I've probably got a slightly controversial view on that. I liken our industry. It's what's been interesting for me is that I obviously work for Midwich, which are a brilliant company in AV. Went away from AV for 10 years and then came back. And what really surprised me was how little had changed. And I liken management in our industry, but very much so in AV, to the Premier League. You've got the same managers being recycled over and over again, and many of them didn't succeed in their previous role, yet they still get another job. And I think for me, if you want to inspire new people, youthful people, fresh people to the industry, then you need leadership that people can relate to, that's younger, fresher, new ideas, new approach. And I think generally most companies tend to take the safe option. And so if you want to change something, you have to change something.
So how would you describe the AV industry to people who are perhaps looking for a more challenging opportunity?
Do you know what's really interesting with the AV industry is I have been, I think there's two levels to the AV industry. You've got the people that kind of work in the AV industry, and it's an amazing community. But the top echelons of the AV industry is a bit of an old boys club. And
still,
very much so, I would say. Mm. So I feel very much that it's a good industry, but I don't see it as a very progressive industry. And I think the danger is now, with the convergence of technology and the change in working habits since the pandemic, actually, the AV industry is becoming demystified and actually becoming more mainstream. And I think that's a real challenge in terms of losing some of the specialism, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but don't you find it's becoming more strategic?
Yeah.
Strategically important.
Yes.
Perhaps. You know, we talk about smart buildings when they're intelligent. You know, that the infrastructure is there as part of the smart building infrastructure, but it's not AV. The AV is the environment in which we work.
Yeah.
And what we expect coming out, whatever front end you're using, and the intuitiveness.
Yeah.
If that's the right word, of what we want out of the technology. And that's, in a way, makes it more invisible. That, we've always said perfect AV is invisible in a sense. You can't see it, but you experience the effects of it.
Totally. I think, ultimately, you just want it to, one, work, and two, be simple. And I think that what's been really exciting to me is I've always been excited by the roles I've done, but really the area that excited me was the transformation of the role, rather than my previous role to this, for example. I ran our business accessories, peripherals and own brand business, which, you know, selling keyboard and mice isn't the most exciting, but the actual, in terms of what we did, was exciting. So the great thing about this role was it is the most exciting area of technology in our industry, in technology. And we are at the forefront in terms of the things that you talk about there, which I think is incredibly exciting.
Well, in terms of changes, the AV interviews I do for AV Magazine, whatever, the last 7 or 8, the people who are leading this, and again, they're mostly male, apart from Kusing Schwenk at Shaw Distribution, have all been former electronics engineers, not salespeople.
Right.
In the old days, there were sales guys doing their due and everything else. Notice a very different type of person leading these companies. Now, that suggests to me something's changing. The way they have to be managed is changing. Are the products, the perception of how they're being sold, I don't know. It's dawned on me gradually. I thought, they have an electronic engineering background. That's interesting. You sort of don't dwell on it too much. But when there are so many of them, one after another.
Yeah, I think one of the things...
quite extraordinary.
Yeah, one of the things we've and I've tried to do since taking this role is use my position to try and drive some change and in inclusion. So we, last year at the Peerless Golf Day, we sponsored a ladies learn to play golf day. So we brought 30 leading females from the industry to the golf day, which was really well received because they felt they weren't included before. We were actually repeating that with a ladies learn to play cricket event at their Lords event coming up next month. Kinley, we've done our second, which Amit and Dave were both at. And I'm pleased to say Dave and I won the non-competitive event on the day.
Brilliant.
And we've done two diversity events with them. We did our own Empower Her event ourselves last year, which went really well. So I think for me, it's about including different people in kind of the future and bringing them to the table. Because I'm a great believer, it's not just about diversity in terms of characteristics, it's about diversity of thinking as well.
Of course it is. I mean, one last anecdote is I used to have a couple of girlfriends, the Charman sisters, and they were the most fantastic demon bowlers I think I've ever come across. And they used to knock everybody out, and they're great batters. And I thought, if anybody tries to support long enough, is coached properly, anybody can do anything, which is your ethos of life, isn't it?
Totally.
Jamie Brothwell, it's been a delight talking to you, and thank you so much for coming into our studio today.
Thank you so much for having me. Really, real pleasure.